Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Melina Draper. Draper received an MFA in poetry from the University of Alaska at Fairbanks and a master's in fiction from the University of New Hampshire. Her work has appeared in Cimarron Review, Borderlands, A Texas Review, and Salamander. Her chapbook, What Better Place Than This, featuring early work, was published in 2003. And this month, her first solo full-length collection, Later the House Stood Empty, will be released by Boreal Books, an imprint of Red Hen Press. Draper currently works as an outreach coordinator for Cornell University's Southeast Asia program. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, did you know early on that poetry was going to be your chosen language for creative expression?
No, I didn't. I tried my hand at a few early poems when I was little, but I always thought I was going to be a fiction writer.
Really?
My father was a fiction writer, and so was my grandfather. And as it turns out, my mother became a poet before I did. Mm. And I turned to poetry after I finished my MA degree at the University of New Hampshire in fiction. I took a workshop with Charles Simic and just became thoroughly excited about it.
That's very interesting that she would go from that to the other. Did you actually start writing poetry before you decided it was going to be your new voice? Just to test it out and see what
sure.
it felt like?
Sure. I mean, it happened organically. I never aspired to be a poet necessarily. I always wanted to be a writer. And my short stories were very poetic. And I wrote one short story in graduate school that had a lot of repetition, a lot of language that sounded very musical. So looking back now, I feel like that was the poetry in the making in the early
stages.
Yeah, it was
a hint coming from the fates. Now, your mother's from Argentina and your father's an American. Did you feel a kind of a pull between two cultures, or are you integrated into both, or do you have a pull of different languages?
I do. I always had a hybrid identity as a child and navigated both worlds, but they were very separate because I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is a tricultural area with Native Americans, Chicanos, mostly from Mexico, or people who've been in the state for four or five generations with Mexican or Spanish heritage, and then Anglos is what we called white people. And out of those three categories, I was more clearly identifiable as an Anglo. But I spoke Spanish fluently. But I didn't look Latina in the way that the Latinos there identify. So it wasn't until I got to college that I started thinking about the complexities of identity and what that meant, and made the decision to raise my children bilingually and tried to keep my options open. I wanted to explore the idea of having a career that could be transnational.
That makes sense. I wish more Americans were bilingual or trilingual. I mean, there's a whole world out there that we're missing out on because we're so English-centric. Now, let's talk about the new collection. It's called Later the House Stood Empty. Talk to us about the evolution of this. Was it thought of as a complete piece, or did you just start writing poems that turned into the work?
So first I just started writing poems, and I basically wrote another collection before I turned to this one that hasn't been published, that was very joyful and silly, and those are the Monsieur Le Peep poems, and Monsieur Le Peep became kind of an alter ego for me that I really enjoyed. And then I suddenly just had a new nucleus of material that I started working with that was exciting. But there were poems about Alaska, poems about New Mexico, which is where I was born, and then a whole collection of poems about Uruguay and Argentina and my early experiences there. Eventually, I did decide I need to write a book. I want to make a book. And then I looked at those three prongs that had been emerging and initially thought, I'll put them all into one collection. But then I thought, I really like Louise Glück's The Wild Iris and many other collections that just were clearly focused around a theme or a topic that was deeply explored, and there was something to be enjoyed in that as well. So I committed to writing the Argentina and Uruguay poems.
Yeah. And where did the title come from? It's a beautiful title.
So the title, thank you, came from the title poem. And I spent some formative years growing up in Uruguay, and in my teens, when I was 17, I had a very close friend whose family was very poor, but they lived in this beautiful mansion, which was an old colonial-style Spanish home.
Wow.
So it already had the feeling of echoing halls, even at that stage when his whole family lived there. And he disappeared and was never found. But I cherished my friendship with his mother as well, so I would stop by after I became a visitor and realized I wasn't going to live there. I would stop by to say hello. Colonia has an old town in the way some European cities do, uh-huh. and which was declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So suddenly all of these old buildings in the old town became incredibly valuable. So they sold their property and left. And so there was one year where, you know, I stopped by and knocked on the door and, you know, there was nobody there anymore.
I was thinking, when you read the whole book, it feels like a metaphor for absences and ghosts and then things that are missing as well. Were you trying to capture that in this book, too? Because it does feel like history, memory, ghosts, places where you're almost looking for home. Is part of this book.
It's true. I think people who have left places that they've loved being suffer from a tremendous nostalgia. And so there's a part of me that's always seeking to return to that. And I just had the strange experience of, you know, going back after several years, several times, and finding the place vastly changed. So the landscape had changed, the people had changed, attitudes had changed. When I was little growing up there, milk was delivered by horse and buggy in a glass jar outside your front door.
Wow.
And that's not the case anymore. And I didn't think to myself, I'm going to write about loss, but those are themes that came out in the collection because I experienced so much loss, and the community experienced loss through beloved members of the community that passed on.
Yeah.
The street dogs, which were characters in of themselves, became a problem, so the city euthanized them, was a loss.
Yeah.
And then I also did research, archival research, into Darwin's notes and letters and the Voyage of the Beagle and all of that went into writing the Voyage of the Beagle. So I went even further back in history to see what had happened before.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about that a bit because you do have a poem about that. In the meantime, I want to have you read from later, The House Stood Empty. This one's called El Tigre. Do you want to tell us about it before or after you read it?
Sure, I can say a little bit about it. It means the tiger, but it refers to an area that surrounds Buenos Aires. It's a delta area that's very beautiful, majestic, old mansions, but everything is run down and decrepit. And so the usual way that you get to Buenos Aires from the other side of the river, which is Colonia, which is where my mother lives and where I spent time growing up, is directly into the main port of Buenos Aires. But you can take the back way in, which is what this poem is about, and it takes you into a different side of the city, and it's more scenic, and you get to go in through rivers and canals and get a sense of people who live on the water and take boats to go to the grocery store. El Tigre. You could get lost in the Tigre Delta, all the serpentine fingers of the Paraná reaching for the sea. The estuary lingers so long it takes them, as it takes all, into itself, out of the heart of the country. You could get lost here among lugubrious mansions, Art Deco, peeling lopsided decks battered by the tidal pull of that siren song moon in the Rio de la Plata. We've taken the back way in. Rusted hulks bleed into the water, ship's graveyard, tires buffer miles of trash from our swale. Not tropical enough for crocodiles. Mosquitoes plenty and willows. Painter Horacio Butler adored El Tigre, its wilted decadence, the failed amusement park, peeling and bored around the final bend. My tios wave from the landing, Buenos Aires teeming behind them. Its dancers' legs are standing on a swamp, its airs the put-on kind. The jungle's breath comes from upriver, a violent, wet feeling. The move from delta to city makes me shiver.
Oh, I love that. It sets up such a great atmosphere. Was a lot of that from memory, or did you do some research for these poems as well?
So A lot of the details are from memory, but I still travel to this area because my mother still lives there. And so the last time I went to El Tigre was maybe 7 years ago or something like this. And it took me about 7 years to write the book. So.
That makes sense to me. Did these poems just bubble up for you? Or once you decided you sort of had a theme, were you deliberately trying to locate memory or history or your own life? How did that process work?
Writing for me is both something, you know, inspired, where I'll just absorb images or experiences or have a dream and then feel compelled to write about it. But there's also a part of it that's about the work, structured, get the task done, get the project done, move the project forward. And I enjoy both sides of it. So a poetry collection is typically about 60 poems. If you have 45, you probably will have a hard time getting your book published, unless they're multiple pages per poem.
You know? So you were thinking in terms of the final
product in some ways. Yeah, once I thought this is going to be a book, then I was thinking I have to write another few poems. And after 50 poems, I thought, I just can't. I've finished everything. What else can I say? So I did have to cast about for topics or things that I thought I hadn't covered or experiences that hadn't been touched on yet.
Yeah. Some of the poets I've talked to say that unless politics, say, flows easily, it starts feeling like propaganda. How do you feel about politics in poetry? I know you have some in here. It's not incredibly strong politics or propagandistic, but tell us what you feel about that.
Well, so interestingly, in Latin America, poets are always political, I would say. There's a long history of poetry being a political cry and tied in with politics. And in fact, poets were often given foreign diplomatic posts where they would be, you know, the consulate for the embassy. Which begins to make more and more sense to me, actually, as I get older and gather more knowledge about the world. I think we should have more poets in the embassies.
It's a beautiful and mysterious language. Going back to your process, I always think poetry sort of bubbles up from some magic place. I mean, not always, but when it does, it's such a moment when at least I feel really alive and like I have something to live for because I'm working on this poem that just came out of the blue. I find that part of it really amazing.
I do. I also appreciate that magic that sometimes just comes from playing in language and the sounds of words or doing a little history on a single word and where that came from. And for politics, it can be similar. I mean, this region that I was writing about was fraught, as any region is, in its particular political history. So those themes came in very naturally. When I was thinking about loss, what people have lost, what's not there anymore, and this idea of reclaiming native heritage as well.
Yeah.
Is present.
I want to have you read another poem from later, The House Stood Empty. This one's called The Protest, 35 Years. Tell us a little bit about it. I found this one really fascinating.
So I do find it challenging to write about politics because the tradition in American poetry is a little bit different. And I don't know if that's because of the sound of the language or had the way that academia affects the shaping of art. So let me read the poem first, and then I'll talk about it. The Protest, 35 Years. Few mothers still march around the Plaza de Mayo obelisk, seeking who was taken from them, who was disappeared. Men with thick mustaches smoke, sip tiny coffees, assert that the girl, Argentina, given the name because her hair was silver and her skin cast its own pale shimmer, left freely on foot across the vineyards of Mendoza into the Andes, a place of prophecies, where surely she must have acquired a poncho to guard against the cold. From there northward to, who knows, rain erases the circled treads around the monument. It might as well snow.
That's great.
So there was a dictatorship in Argentina where there was severe repression, and many of the intellectuals, poets, artists, any political dissenters were disappeared. They were murdered. Their bodies were thrown into the river or buried. Children were abducted from their parents. So a group of women started a protest.
I remember hearing about this. I mean, this did get into the Western press.
It made it, and there was a movie about it. And mostly they were grandmothers. So they were women who realized that they had a certain power, a certain way in which the society protected them because of their age. They carried a kind of wisdom with them. And so they just silently protested around this monument. I think now it's every Thursday they still walk. Some people have been found. Some of their grandchildren have been found. Slowly over time, and records, hundreds of photographs and searching. And does your child look like anybody in these pictures? They might have been an abducted child if you adopted in the 70s.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Melina Draper. We're talking about her new collection of poetry called Later the House Stood Empty. You know, I want to talk to you. You've taught writing in various places. There's a lot of debate going on now whether MFA programs are ruining writers, you know, cranking them out like cookie cutters. Well, what is your feeling about that? Do you think training does sort of interfere with creativity at certain points? Tell us what you think.
I don't think so. I think that the road to being an artist or a craftsperson takes many years and a set of skills that require time and dedication. And so writing programs have the opportunity to accelerate that process a little bit because it allows you the time and space to just focus on that with few other distractions. Mm-hmm. I felt before entering graduate school just a great desire to be a writer, but I didn't have the habit of being a writer. So what I wanted from graduate school was to acquire the habit of writing, be exposed to opportunities to read, and then to work with other writers. So those were the greatest blessings. A lot of writers are very solitary people. You don't have to go through an MFA program to be a writer or to be a successful writer. But even now that I've been out of graduate school, I still seek out other writers to collaborate with share work in progress with.
Yeah, I do. I find it fascinating talking to writers and hearing about their process. Mm-hmm. And I do it through the show. Not everybody can do that either. But you can't teach anybody creativity. I mean, even if people have the tools, you know, I mean, that's what I hear a lot of people saying. A lot of people are getting MFAs and they're not really cut out to be in that world in some ways. But whatever the process is, at least people are being literate, because there's
right. At the very least, they're reading stuff from around the world and growing as human beings
and being exposed to language, which is seems to be slipping away from us in this high tech era. Now, I want to have you read another poem from Later the House Stood Empty. This one's called The Gift.
The Gift. Maria took me for kind and wise. In my wide-eyed foreigner silence. It's true I let my gaze linger on her features. It's true some gazes feel like a caress. She told me her story while I took in her long dark hair, woven with silver in the garden light, eyes Kalamata bruised, darting left to right, her hand warm in mine. She worked hard despite her failing body, mind that would not keep steady. Winter nights, her house was cold next to the river, where an old girlfriend let her stay out of pity or obligation. Before she died, she gave me, in gratitude for listening, an earthen pot, rustic, mud-made, too fragile to carry with her.
That last line I found really haunting. Do you write in English?
I do write
almost
in English.
Exclusively. Mm-hmm. I was wondering about that, because some of your work almost has a flavor of having been translated, mm-hmm. not necessarily by someone, but in your own head.
I am fully bilingual, so I did have some quirks that I discovered as I was working on this book that probably had to do with being bilingual.
Yeah, it's like you end. Mm-hmm. You put periods where some of us would put another word, which I find interesting. No, I find it interesting. It's like a ghost inhabits the line, and I love it that way. It reminds me of Isabel Allende and Marquez and those people who they seem to trade in ghosts in most of their writing. Now, you and your mom collaborated on a book. Your mom, as you said, is a poet. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that? It was called Place of Origin.
Mm-hmm.
And you won an award for it, didn't you?
We did. It was a wonderful collaboration. We live thousands of miles apart. She's in Uruguay, and I live in upstate New York in Geneva. But at the time that we worked on this project, I think I was already in Alaska. I also lived in Massachusetts before that. We just deeply missed each other and traded. She's one of my first readers. We trade poems back and forth and urge each other on. And at some point, we dreamed up this project to try to do a book together. And the editor at Oyster River Press was excited and is committed to publishing books of bilingual poetry. So it was a way to reach across generations and spend some time together and spend some time with the two languages back and forth. So I translated her poems into English. She translated my poems into Spanish.
Oh, that's what it was. Were the poems talking to each other like a mother and daughter would, or are they separate? I haven't seen the collection.
They were, but that just happened through the strange things that some people call coincidence, or the way in which we would just share work back and forth and topics that inspire me also inspire her sometimes. So the book is about family and children and what you wish for your children that turns out differently, loss of elders and parents and how you still feel them in your life.
Yeah. Who are the writers that have influenced you? Are you influenced by the South American writers? American writers, anyone?
Oh, yes. I think I'm influenced by all writers. And I have writers that I like to read. So even when I was reading El Tigre, I thought, oh, there's some Elizabeth Bishop in that poem. And I love Emily Dickinson. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned Louise Gluck earlier.
And do you read some of the poets who have written in Spanish in their original language, too?
I do. As I was writing this book, I wanted to turn to the poets who had written about this river, which is very capped. It's a moody river because it's called the Rio de la Plata, which means the River of Silver. Mostly it's a muddy brown.
Of course.
But at dawn and at dusk, it's stunningly beautiful. So I looked to Borges and Alfonsina Storni, who were two poets who wrote about the river. I also read some Neruda who wasn't writing about that particular river, but I've taken courses on Latin American poetry because I wanted to study them. And then my grandfather, who was a writer as well, befriended the independent bookstore owners on his block.
Wow.
And so whenever I go to Buenos Aires, I stop in, talk to the bookstore people, ask them to recommend contemporary Argentine poetry for me to take home. And then
when you go back to the country where Spanish is the primary language, do you translate your own poems into Spanish on the spot, or do you already have them translated before you go?
My mom and I both face this problem because she's writing primarily in Spanish, and so she'll come to the States. And we will impromptu translate each other's poetry for somebody on the spot, close friends, people who we really want to share our work with, like my grandmother. I'd like her to hear something from the collection.
Yeah.
But translation is its own intense work.
Especially with poetry.
Yeah, so I aspire to commit, always have aspired to commit to it more as time goes on and bring other writers into English. And my mom now has 4 books out, and 3 of them haven't been translated into English. So I would like to spend some time translating more of her work.
Yeah. That's important because the language is different, even if it's translated into English. And I always find it incredibly enriching to hear the different sounds. Let's get one more poem in from later, The House Stood Empty. This one's called Panoramic, Darwin and Me.
Panoramic, Darwin and Me. I'm 17, he's 24, set to sail round the Horn to the Strait of Magellan, months from the Galapagos birds, 20 years from origin of species. though what to make of the story of Earth in evidence of sea on land? What of these remains of mollusca, whose relatives still live offshore while others are nowhere else found? He walked across the land I call home to net, pickle, pack, ship, in service to science, captain, and queen. His letters name the places I love, and when he is tired of it and ready to move away from that stupid, unpicturesque side of America, I forgive him. No revenge in knowing what's to come. He's still a century away from the throng of millions of Spanish and Italians, my great-great-grandfather among them, 2 centuries from native population 3%, though Rosa's killing has begun. There is now carrying on a bloody war of extermination against the Indians. This inheritance I do not want to own.
This is where history mingles with the ghosts that we were talking about earlier. I like that poem a lot.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you about the fact that you live now in the Finger Lakes. I've talked to a lot of writers about how this beautiful landscape has influenced their work. Has it influenced your work? Are we going to see you writing about your here and now?
Yes, I would say it's beginning to. I'm writing new work, and it's set here. In the past, I've generally, when I wrote this book, it was all about something in the past, 10 years ago or more. So it's different for me to be writing about the here and now. But I've started to because it's just exciting. I have a new partner. I went from being straight to being a lesbian. So I feel like my entire identity has changed, and I need to start afresh. And you
know, that's interesting. But do you still have the residual ghosts from this book? Or might we see another collection of poems that weren't in this, perhaps?
Probably not. I'm now interested in writing more about my current milieu and life now. I do have half of a collection about New Mexico, which is similar in tone to this one, about that childhood that I can't get back. So that may eventually turn into a full book-length project.
You know, you have certainly chosen some extreme atmospheres to live in. Alaska, New Mexico, now you're here in the Finger Lakes. Did you deliberately look for dramatic places to live? I mean, you didn't just live in, you know, some little town in the Midwest. You go to these extreme places.
I also lived in Maine for a couple of years.
That's kind of an extreme coastline, at least.
Yeah. I always knew that I would travel and be somewhat nomadic ever since I was a little girl. So I let my life take me where it went, and it happened to go to those locations.
Yeah, and lucky we are because it brings back poetry. We only have a couple minutes left. Do you want to give some contact information or let us know about any readings you might be giving in the next month or two?
Sure. I do have a website, melinadraper.drupalgardens.com, and I keep any updates about upcoming readings listed there, as well as links to interviews or other things. There's a few recordings for people to listen to.
Well, Melina Draper, thank you so much for joining us. Keep writing. This is an absolutely wonderful collection.
Thank you.
Again, it's called Later the House Stood Empty. Go out and buy it, everybody. It's really a fascinating trip through Melina's life as well as history.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.